the payday lending bill dies. Pete Buttigieg makes things official. That, plus the Mueller report released, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 19th, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, a controversial bill that created new payday lending products, which consumer advocates called predatory loans, died on the House floor. Republicans had argued the bill would have created what they called a middle option between payday lending and traditional bank loans, but still with high interest rates. Proponents of the measure argued Hoosiers with bad credit have too few options for loans outside of payday lending. Opponents, such as the Indiana Institute for Working Families, had spoken out against the bill from its inception, and it only narrowly passed the Senate. They argued the rates and fees were still too high, rates that in some cases would have been allowed to exceed the state's legal limit of 72%. The legislation's House sponsor, Republican Representative Matt Lehman, opted not to call the bill down for passage Monday, the deadline to pass it out of the House. That signaled it didn't have enough support in the chamber. What's the future of payday lending reform? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Phil Johnson, this is the second session in a row a bill like this hasn't made it to the finish line. So do you see it coming back for a third go-round?
You know, Brandon, if I was a betting man, I would say that we're likely to see this again next year. But for now, I think the bill is dead and buried. So I think kudos to the advocates who mobilized to defeat this thing. I think they did a great job.
And, you know, depending on how the gaming bill goes, you might be able to
bet
on that in a few weeks.
Sports betting man.
Is this an issue that I asked this when we talked about it a few weeks ago on this show, which is if it does come back in another year, which seems kind of likely, is this an issue that is just crying out for some sort of compromise?
Yeah, I think so. I think the reason we're here with this shorter product to begin with is the Obama administration took very deliberate steps to eliminate the payday industry. But there's a recognition among state lawmakers that there's $1 billion in subprime lending in Indiana alone. And there, so there is a demand for this. There are people that just don't have access to cash from traditional sources. But what's the balance between allowing a company to charge really high interest rates on an unsecured loan and making sure that that's still accessible? I think if you just look big picture, ultimately I think the path forward is a trade-off for the elimination of payday in place of a lower interest, longer-term product that allows people to kind of build a credit profile, yeah, and have a credit score that's actually helpful when used responsibly.
Is that, you know, sometimes we joke about, oh, it'll just get sent to study committee. But is this an issue that actually could use the intervening year to really come up with something like what Mike just talked about?
Perhaps. I mean, increasingly, the whole study committee option is used ostensibly, yes, to study issues, but it's also used as a pressure relief valve when nobody wants to deal with an issue in a given session. It's a great way to punt. And as we've seen with some high-profile issues, all the study in the world doesn't necessarily result in any kind of legislative proposal that anyone heeds and that actually goes anywhere when all is said and done. It will come back, and that's a guarantee. And there are a billion reasons, as Mike suggested. When you talk about an industry where the stakes are so high and where there is so much money to be made or lost, it will come back. And the tough thing for lawmakers, lastly, is this an issue? There are two ways to look at this. Clearly, you know, there are people who are seen by many people as victims of usury, of these high
predatory lending
and yeah, so forth. But then for some people, this is an economic development issue, not only for on an individual basis, but for companies. You know, supposedly this is a state that has the sign posted, we want business, we want...
We are a state that works.
We're a state that works, and there, frankly, are a lot of people who work in that industry and are receive paychecks from that industry,
and they're loath
to get rid of it.
It was pointed out in testimony that there is a gap here, that there are people who can't get, like you pointed out, there are people who can't get this money who might need it, who have a car bill to pay,
a lot of
medical bill
to pay.
Paycheck,
and there's just no option when the tire blows, and you got to get to work.
I felt like Phil referenced the people who mobilized against this, and I felt like that was a lot more acute this session than it was last year, even though the bill also died last year. Does that increase the pressure for finding that sort of compromise ground?
Yeah, they had a broad coalition of a number of groups. They got veterans involved, and that really seemed to make a difference. I actually don't think a study would do anything on this. I think the facts are out there. We would just hear the same exact testimony that we've heard the last 2 days or 2 years. I think, Mike's got an answer right there. I mean, but there has to be something for those people who are so against payday loans. You've got to have to give them something, not just add to the expensive options, but also take something away, I think.
Yeah. When they mobilized, they were effective, but what they've done is just preserve the market for only payday.
Yeah.
Now there is no lower interest option.
Right, nothing. It's just
so they shot at payday and they preserved it.
Yeah. Well, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg this week made his presidential bid official with a campaign kickoff in the northern Indiana city.
After months of an exploratory bid, Pete Buttigieg made things official.
My name is Pete Buttigieg. They call me Mayor Pete. I am a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States.
Buttigieg's poll numbers and fundraising dollars have climbed fast since he first announced he was exploring a presidential run. He's appeared frequently on national news programmings, pitching his vision for the country, and the latest polls in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states in the presidential primary process, have him third among the large Democratic field. Both the national and state Republican parties sent out blasts aimed at Buttigieg surrounding his announcement. They accuse him of pursuing a radical agenda while at the same time criticizing him for what they deem a lack of any major accomplishments.
Mike O'Brien, our conversation about this Buttigieg bid so far has been around its long shot nature and what he would have to do to make it count. But now, after the last few weeks, is he in the top tier of Democratic candidates?
Of declared candidates, I think he is. Yeah, but I mean, you got to think about where we're at in the process. It's small ball right now. It's Iowa caucuses. It's sitting in people's living rooms. It's and we don't have the top tier candidates in the other top tier candidates, the ones that are kind of the presumptive Joe Biden and the big names are still haven't officially gotten into the race.
But so, I mean, Joe Biden is one who there's no guarantee now he will get into the race. So if Joe Biden doesn't get into the race, does that blow things open even more?
It opens it up until, at some point the DNC, I think, is going to lock down this process and go and pick, because they have a lot more control at their convention who they're picking than others, and through this primary process. But I mean, you got to give him credit. He's a mayor of a small town with not a real record. I mean, he's got a great resume, being a veteran Oxford grad and all the rest. So you got to give him credit for what he's doing. The lead up to this, where he just tried to leverage being from Indiana and shooting at Mike Pence, which the media loves, so they gave him a lot of attention. That worked to his benefit. As you move closer to Iowa, and then New Hampshire, another small state, and then South Carolina. I mean, yeah, there's a path for any of these candidates. The question is a moderate Midwestern mayor of a pretty small town, relatively.
Yeah.
Where does he fit in the Democratic Party right now? Because he doesn't fit in the one that is the loudest, which is impeach Trump, Green Deal, higher taxes, and all the rest.
To that point, where does Pete Buttigieg fit in the Democratic Party?
Top of the tier right now. And Mike mentioned living rooms. I think Pete had 1,500 people in Des Moines this week. That was not in a living room. That was quite the rally. So it's definitely moved from a moment to a movement. I think they've proven, the Pete campaign has proven, that they're serious and they could be contenders. So where does he fit? I think the process here is going to play itself out. And I think as a Democrat, I'm excited about how wide open this field is. But Pete has proven that they've proven that they can run a very credible campaign here quickly and taken the excitement around his announcement into what is, I think, a campaign that can go the distance.
As we try to measure a top-tier candidate, is what we saw from the other side of the aisle more proof of the new stratosphere that he seems to have entered?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, he's polling two or three in everything. So I mean, he is top tier. But yes, I mean, for weeks we heard not a word from Republicans. And then all of a sudden it was like just an avalanche of going after him, which truly shows that they were like, you know, oh no, he's starting to gain legs and, you know, get some traction. So they really went after him. I mean, you know, the criticism he's from both sides, by the way, criticism from both sides, he's starting to hear, you know.
They'll start shooting him out on the Democratic side, too. Because, I mean, if he is in the top tier, I mean, the other guys.
Is he not Christian enough? Is he, you know, or has he not accomplished enough as a mayor? I mean, that's all going to be happening here in the next couple.
I think those attacks have largely slid off so far.
Nothing seems so sticky so far.
He's handling it pretty deftly.
It is early in the process. I'll ask this question, though, which is something I imagine we'll talk about again on this show before all is said and done, but is the mayor of the fourth largest city of Indiana have enough experience to be president of the United States?
The rules don't apply anymore. If you ask me 20, 30 years ago, based on what I had seen, witnessed firsthand in this profession or studied in college or in high school civics even, I would have said no. But look at what we've had since.
Yeah.
A lot of people with zero governmental experience, or not a lot, I guess. Let's not use words, overdo it. But I don't think that's a stopper anymore. And I think some people actually would see municipal government experience as being in some ways preferable to the gridlock of Washington. It's sort of, you get the notion of experience in dealing with public policy issues and problems without whatever sort of stink goes with being in Congress. And again, I can't believe the harsh words you have for our nation's 371st largest city, which is a stat I think you.
I was trying to pull that number back, and I couldn't remember.
Well, I only remember. I hope you're right, because I just repeated it as if it's fact.
Well,
so
I remembered Governor Holcomb called South Bend an engine for economic growth too. So obviously,
it might break 370 by the end of this whole thing.
It's a little ironic where the announcement was. It was actually a Mike Pence project that he granted to
the
regional cities program.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Pete Buttigieg be the Democratic nominee for president in 2020? We'll be asking this again, I bet. A yes, B no, or C, it's too early to tell. Last week's question, who is right about faith and homosexuality, Pete Buttigieg or Mike Pence? 71% of you say it was Pete, 19% say it's the vice president, and 10% say neither. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, special counsel Robert Mueller's report about Russian interference in the 2016 election was released, redacted, to the public this week. The 448-page document, released after a nearly two-year-long inquiry, says Mueller's investigation did not establish that the Trump campaign, quote, conspired or coordinated with the Russian interference effort, which was described as, quote, sweeping and systematic. But it does contain dramatic revelations of happenings inside the Oval Office, including an account quoting the president worrying the investigation could spell the end of his presidency. And the report cites instances of Trump aides stopping his attempts to impede the investigation. Mueller detailed 10 episodes involving actions by Trump that might have constituted obstruction of justice, but he could not conclude that the president committed a crime.
Sure does.
John Schwanes, does this change anything politically speaking?
I think what this does is give ammunition to those on both sides. If you thought going in that this was a witch hunt or the collusion delusion, pick your choice, then you can find pieces of this that say, there, I rest my case. If in fact you think that this is a historically bad presidency that's tainted by scandal at every turn, you can probably find evidence to make that argument too. The irony is, it seems to me, and this was spelled out in the report, that if in fact the presidential aides who had been ordered to carry out and execute some of these instructions, these presidential edicts, had actually listened to their boss, then there might have been very clear grounds for obstruction of justice. He was saved effectively by people who ignored him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess even that's a somewhat tempered celebration. Hey, I won, but that's because nobody listens to me among my staffers.
There's clearly, with the release of the report and as people have started to dig into it, there is clearly growing
talk or a reignited talk on the Hill of the idea of impeachment. Do you think that's a legitimate possibility before the end of 2020?
No. First of all, it would take forever if they even started out that process, and I just don't see it going through that. I mean, I found the takeaway, other than what you were saying with the whole, you know, thank God his staffers ignored him type thing. I mean, they need a bonus. Half of them probably don't have a job anymore. But also the takeaway was how clear the Russian interference was, which, as far as I'm concerned, is, I mean, Donald Trump is still kind of denying. I mean, he absolutely still won't say that. So that's intriguing on its own.
Do you think this changes anything? As we look ahead to 2020, let's put it that way, do you think this changes? Does you think this plays to a very big role in that?
I'm actually with Nikki here. I agree. I think the report is very clear about Russian interference, and I think it doesn't give me a warm and fuzzy feeling knowing that the occupant of the White House was playing footsie with adversarial governments. And quite frankly, it's not clear that we've done that much to make sure that the 2020 election isn't susceptible to a similar attack. So. I am a Twitter legal expert, so in terms of obstruction, I'm not positive there. I have a feeling that this special counsel will be up on Capitol Hill quite soon, and feel free to invite me back then, and I'll give you my legal opinion then. But.
As far as Twitter legal analysis goes, is this another one, like John said, where both sides will take what they want and move on?
Yeah, I don't think the needle moved very much, but I think the couple takeaways. One, I hope Congress drags Mueller onto the Hill, and I hope, and the president has already said, that's fine. We're not going to stand in the way of that, just like they didn't stand in the way of access to campaign staff and access to White House staff. I mean, it's clear
and even,
that
even
the president
there was
could
a
have
lot
exercised.
Less, there was also a lot less redacted than some people
and some of that was because of ongoing legal issues. Like, you couldn't
present
that as evidence.
What was redacted,
The president could have exercised privilege, he didn't. Some of the report was like a soap opera, but if you wanted to try to prove that the White House is dysfunctional, just go on Twitter. You know, like, there's a free website and you could have taken no time to do it.
There was an element
to years
that a lot of what was in the report had been out there already, and it sort of confirmed a lot of media reports
were denied in real time, but now we see definitely had truth to them.
But and we didn't learn very much other than what I actually agree with both of you. He did methodically lay out efforts by the Russian government to interfere in the election. It should be pointed out the Obama administration knew about that and didn't do anything about it at the time. And we should, on a bipartisan basis, try to work this year to secure, make sure the 2020 election is secure. Not that it affected the outcome. I think the president still gets touchy about did it affect the outcome of the election. Is this legitimate? Yeah. I think that's the source of that. We don't know the answer. We'll never know the answer to that. But we should come together for 20 and make sure that's secure.
Well, Indiana budget writers will have about $100 million less to work with than previously anticipated after a new revenue forecast was unveiled this week.
A new forecast predicts Indiana will collect about $33 million less over the next 2 years than the last forecast from December projected. Combine that with more money needed for Medicaid, and state lawmakers have $100 million total less to work with than they previously thought. Republican budget architect Ryan Mishler says that forces some difficult conversations.
We have to sit down and see, you know, the priorities of the caucuses and the administration and see what we're willing to cut out, basically.
House budget architect Todd Houston says the sides aren't far apart.
We're all aligned. We want to provide the best possible services to the most needy of our population, but find the appropriate way to do it within costs.
Nikki Kelly, how much does this change things with just about a week of session ago?
I don't think much at all. Obviously, to normal people, $100 million is a huge amount of money. But we're talking about a $34.6 billion budget. And all three versions of the budget had built in a solid cushion. So I think they could, I mean, if they wanted, they could literally just lop that off, have a little less in surplus and go. So
a little less in surplus sounds like heresy at the Republican.
There are those who would start saying that AAA bond rating may be at risk.
Funny, a little less than they had planned, not under their 11% minimum.
They built in reserves of more than the 11%.
This would be up to 12.5%, but who's counting? I'm so glad you brought this up, because I have not touted and shamelessly promoted Indiana lawmakers for weeks.
That's true.
And now that we're almost at the end of the season, that is the topic this week on many of these same public television channels. And I asked the budget negotiators who were sitting around this table whether they needed to bring a power saw to the negotiations or some fine grit sandpaper. little poetry, more reason to tune in. Everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike, said, just a little sandpaper. This is just a little edging. This is not a major overhaul. It's not a crisis. They feel that they had built this into the end of the budget, and I think this is really just a blip.
Todd Houston pointed out that they're aligned on the big issues, education funding, teacher pay, DCS, those sorts of things. So is it going to be then, if there is sandpaper needed, is it not going to be the big things, but little things that a lot of people don't even notice that are going to be the ones that all of a sudden just disappear?
Well, sometimes it can't be the big things. I mean, like, you have an obligation to pay for Medicaid and public education and other things, but you know, I give Anna a hard time about always bringing up the corporate income tax. My version of that is always talking about the surplus. This is why you have a surplus. So you don't have to worry when $100 million comes in under $100 million and you got to go figure it out. It's also why you don't go spend the surplus on teacher pay and everything else, because you do need it. It's a part of the budget process, and it provides stability for the state of Indiana for the next 2 years.
Does it give maybe more credence, though, to what Senate Republicans proposed in their budget, which is instead of using surplus dollars to pay down a teacher pension fund, and instead of using and going in and after a transportation fund to help pay for DCS, to avoid some of those surplus dipping when you have a little less money to work with, is actually going to give more credence to what Senate Republicans are proposing there?
No, I gas tax dollars shouldn't go to pay DCS, and I think we all agree here that there's just need sandpaper in this budget, so I think
we should have trademarked this a long time ago.
that lawmakers should meet their obligation to DCS, which was at $286 million. It's what the agency said that they needed over the biennium to get it done.
Yeah.
Fully expect that to happen here. I don't think we have any resource issue to get that done. I think the big thing for this, and Mike mentioned it, talking about teacher pay, if I'm a teacher and I'm looking at my paycheck a month after session, 6 months after session, a year after session, I'm not going to see it go up from this budget. I'm just not. It's not going to happen.
How do you know that, though? I mean, they're providing $500 million more in new education dollars.
That is going to the overall fund, or going to
no,
educational
that's
funding.
That's tuition
that's
support.
K-12.
It's going to support in general, right?
Right.
It has to fund other things in the classroom, too. It doesn't all go. It's not getting driven
all
over.
No, but the majority
the
of it.
And that's you might get your appreciation grant that's a little bit larger under this distribution system, if that's what ends up
that's
being the system than you would have gotten in the past.
1003 puts the spend parameter in place. If you're below 85%, there's an accountability piece to this to try to drive. Because you're right, it's a local decision what to pay your teachers. It's locally bargained.
I just think no one should, once they pass this budget, it's a two-part process. Legislators give it, then we see what the local districts decide to do with it. I don't think they should decide automatically, well, they didn't give us enough, until we see that second part.
So should teachers expect a pay raise from this budget?
They should.
Yes, they should.
Because
okay.
Their district is getting a record amount of money. And if they don't spend that money on teacher pay, there's going to be an accountability for that. And it's going to come from the top. It's going to come from the state. I don't know. When we talked about this in past weeks, I don't know if the state takes this over ultimately. I don't know if that's even better for teachers. But the only real answer is the state takes over what a teacher is paid.
Do you like the idea that the Senate Republicans put in, which was on the teacher pension part, that once those dollars, once schools don't have to pay those dollars into the teacher pension fund because the state is paying that liability, that they will have to have a public meeting where they explain, okay, here's how much we saved and here's what we're going to spend it on? Do you like that?
I do
kind
like
of
that. Yeah, because they're trying to figure out a way without hammering them, providing some kind of political accountability at the local level, where you've got to get up and say, we got a record amount of money, we're not giving it to teachers, and here's why.
Yeah. I think a lot of those districts are already at the 85% spend. Do we have a list or a percentage of corporations that are already spending 85%?
We will, when I start reporting.
Yeah.
When they report it.
Yeah. And it's not all, of them are at 85%, but there are not a small number who are at 85%. Well, House Speaker Brian Bosma has recused himself from all votes on this session's major gaming bill because of work at his private law firm.
The Indianapolis Star reports Republican House Speaker Brian Bosma is working for the Vigo County Capital Improvement Board, which is among entities supporting the bill to allow a proposed Terre Haute casino. Bosma told the House Ethics Committee he was first contacted about the work by then Vigo County board member Greg Gibson, an investor in Spectacle Entertainment, which owns the Gary Casinos and seeks to move one of those licenses to Terre Haute. Bosma says the contract hasn't influenced his legislative actions.
Phil Johnson, is this just the consequence of a citizen legislature?
No, it's not. It's not. In fact, I think this has become a pattern that we've seen at the Indiana legislature. We've seen what is becoming a culture of corruption here, where folks, I mean, how frequently has this happened? I think last week We were talking about Curtis Hill not following the state's ethics law or not following the public records law. I think the week before that we were talking about illegal flights. Now we're talking about the speaker. I mean, there are issues here. There clearly are.
But the reporting says direct pecuniary interest, yeah. And that isn't even involved here.
I think this is the byproduct of a citizen legislature. And every time someone the nature of corruption is you concealed it for your own benefit. He offered this voluntarily and said, I'm removing myself from this process.
And technically didn't even have to.
But politically, even if it looks like he's got that kind of interest in it, you've got to go explain that. He erred on the side of caution, and every time this comes up, you're reminded that the incentive is for them to not disclose it because they get hammered.
Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Phil Johnson, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.